It is a pleasure to introduce our next instructor based in Boston. Gary Mishuris is the managing partner of Silver Ring Value Partners, an investment firm with a concentrated long-term value approach. Before founding the firm in 2016, Gary was a managing director at Manulife Asset Management since 2011, where he was the lead portfolio manager of the U.S. Focused Value Strategy. Earlier in his career, Gary worked as a research associate at Fidelity and vice president at Evergreen Investments, later part of Wells Capital. Gary holds degrees in computer science and economics from MIT. He has shared his wisdom and ideas with our members in the past, and we are grateful that Gary has chosen this opportunity to be with us again. So on behalf of the MOI Global membership community, a warm welcome back to you, Gary. The floor is yours. Please go ahead.
Thank you, John, and thank you again for having me. I've been a long-term member of the MOI Global community, and I really like what you've done and the sense of community and shared learning that you've built. So thank you for that. So today, I'm going to talk about Arcadis, which is a Dutch domicile company. But first, you know, just kind of framing the investment process. And I'm going to skip through some of these slides because John was kind enough to introduce me already. But at Silver Ring, the hope is that there's a combination of competence, alignment, and real passion, which I always believe the intrinsic motivators are more powerful than extrinsic ones. In terms of our competitive advantage, it's really not one thing, but a combination of a long-term time horizon, which is supported by the long time horizon of our LP base, a limited asset base, a microeconomic focus, and a temperament which allows me to stick to the process as opposed to get rattled by behavioral biases and market volatility. Investment philosophy, it's an intrinsic value approach. The margin of safety to me means a combination of the quality of the business and the price in terms of the discount from intrinsic value. I already mentioned a long-term time horizon. It's very important, especially since so much of the market is short-term based. Rational and disciplined execution, I think it's important to not just have a process in a pitch deck, but actually do it. And I've seen, you know, this is my 18th year in the business, and I've seen too many a time when the process doesn't really move off the slides into the real world. And finally, a concentrated portfolio. I certainly know that I'm going to be wrong some percentage of the time, and I've been humbled many a time in my career, but at the same time, I think it's important to create a portfolio where there is, you know, both a substantial amount of time that can be devoted to the due diligence process, and also where, you know, that work can have a chance of having a meaningful impact on the results. So today, as I mentioned, I'm going to talk about Arcadis. And the business really is, it's a consulting engineering company. It's asset light. They don't really take on contract risk, unlike some companies that are more in the construction part of the business. So you can think of it as a specialty consulting business, whether it's so McKinsey for this narrow domain, if you will. And it's a bit of a turnaround, although it's not a deep turnaround. You have a new CEO that we'll talk about. And you have a business that used to operate a 10% operating margin that's now operating close to 7%. And at the same time, I think the business is certainly above average, and I'll talk about why. And I think the balance sheet is okay. And there is a substantial, you know, short interest out there, and the short selling community feels otherwise. So that's going to be partially a focus of my discussion today, because I think I have a lot of respect for short sellers and the work they do, and I want to address those concerns. I think the opportunity here, if I'm right, we're getting a pretty decent business at roughly half of what I think it's worth in the base case, with a downside to worst case of about 30%. And just to kind of frame that, you know, I tend to have a fairly severe downside to worst case approach, so think of this as a two standard deviation event, and I'll walk through what that means. So moving forward, so I think, you know, just starting to frame my overall approach to researching a company, I have a five-step research process. So step number one is company quality assessment. Step number two is figuring out what are the key variables that I would like to know to figure out the future of this business. Step number three is financial modeling. Step number four is valuation. And importantly, step number five is a behavioral checklist to make sure I'm not, I'm minimizing biases and I'm aware of potential behavioral forces that could be influencing my decision. And the goal really is to answer two questions. First, how predictable are the long-term economics of this business? And secondly, what's the reasonable range of intrinsic values? And of course, value is always a range. No one is good enough, I don't think, to figure out just one single point estimate in most cases. So we go to step one. Step one really has three components. First, there's business quality, and that's a combination of how attractive is the industry and how strong is the company's sustainable competitive advantage. Secondly, it's the management quality, and that's a combination of track record of operations and capital allocation, as well as alignment of incentives. And finally, it's the balance sheet quality. And here we're trying to figure out, is the company over-levered and can or not, and can it withstand temporary adversity without meaningfully reducing the value of the security? So just an overview of the business. So as I mentioned, that Arcese is a global engineering consultancy. It's a little bit of a niche company, so it's certainly not the biggest, but it has pretty strong positions in certain niches, such as it's number two in water, it's number one in buildings, and it's number three international design firm by ENR rankings. You can see that it has a fairly broad geographic distribution, but a fairly big piece of the business is outside the U.S. The U.S. is actually a minority of the business. Europe is kind of the stronghold, if you will, of this company in terms of its history. And it has a fairly broad portfolio in terms of different types of projects that it does as well. This is kind of a slide to kind of put this into context. So there certainly are a few bigger companies, and the industry certainly has been seeing some consolidation over the last few years. But this is a fairly scale company. It's one of the larger players in the markets that it competes in for the most part. So in terms of structural attractiveness of the business, so I think the industry is of above average structural attractiveness. And what leads me to that conclusion is that I think, there are reasonable barriers to entry. While it's certainly not capital, it's a capital-light business, you do need to have both reputation and experience in order to credibly bid for the project. And you also need to have, or at least it would really help to have client relationships, both as reference clients and potentially for new business from existing clients. I think that there is some, buyers do have some leverage. So you have some governments that are clients, and you have some, very large companies that are putting out work for a bid. But I also think that by and large, they are looking for the quality and not just the lowest bid, because a lot of the cost is going to be in execution, which these companies don't do. And so there's a pretty big, risk of taking the low bid, having a suboptimal design, and ending up with a situation where, sure, you minimize this part of the cost structure for the project, but overall, either the project doesn't get done well, or it doesn't serve its function well, or the overall cost is actually higher. There's really no substitutes for this. You need, companies can't really insource this for the most part. It doesn't make sense to have, full-time engineering design staff full-time for occasional projects. Bridges and things like that, until they invent a teleporting machine, aren't going to go obsolete. And suppliers, there's not that many of them. It's really people, and top talent can certainly command some bargaining power, but by and large, there are many fewer employers than there are employees, and the companies don't have trouble finding qualified people. So I would say overall, the competitive intensity is medium. There's definitely an oligopoly characteristic to this business, and I would say it's definitely not a commodity business. In terms of competitive advantage, I would say for Arcese specifically, there are three items to note. One is a strong reputation in key niches such as environmental and water. Another is just the quality organization of engineers and designers capable of doing the work well and having the reputation for doing so. And then number three is a long-term track record of doing similar projects that leads to many reference clients that will likely influence future wins. So I think overall, the company has a moderate competitive advantage. I certainly don't want to misrepresent it and claim that it's, this is not an Amazonian type moat, but they do have an advantage. And I would say that if you look at, the history of the company, I always like to say, well, if I think qualitatively there's an advantage, shouldn't it show up in numbers such as return on capital? You can see that over time they have earned well in excess of their cost of capital. The last couple of years, the returns have come down, but even then, they're still slightly above on average versus their cost of capital. And we'll talk about why I think that the current level of profitability is temporary. So overall, I would say Arcades is an above average business due to the combination of above average industry attractiveness and a moderate competitive advantage. So management quality, you know, I think, as I mentioned earlier, there are two components. One is, are they competent? And that goes along the lines of, are they competent at operating the business, and are they competent allocating capital? And second of all, are they aligned with us as shareholders? So just to give you a little bit of a history on management, so there were kind of three eras. The old CEO who kind of really put the business together over many years, Harry Noy, left in 2012. He pursued a combination of organic growth and acquisitions. He was replaced by a gentleman by the name of Neil MacArthur, who was a CEO from 2012 until the end of 2016. He was really a former consultant, and he managed the company by spreadsheet and PowerPoint. No, he didn't really have a real engineering background. And what ended up happening was he set top-down targets and then forced people to meet them, not really understanding what that meant for the business and the, you know, the implications that those incentives are going to cause. And so the board actually fired him, which is a little bit unusual. Usually you need some activist, you know, and to get involved or someone. But in this case, and I'll talk about this in a minute, there's a foundation that owns about 18% of this company that is employee-led and that basically acts as long-term capital, or part of the long-term capital base of this company. So the board actually fired him, said, thank you, it's been 5 years, you haven't met your objectives, and we don't like what we're seeing. And they brought in the current CEO, Peter, who came from Fluor, where he was the COO, and prior to that, where he was the president of their energy and chemicals business. So very relevant background. He's an engineer by background, which I think is important for this organization, which did not like being managed by a consultant who didn't really fully get what their business was all about. And his focus is much more on organic growth. So he is going to do a few talk-ins here and there. He recently bought a digital business where he's trying to digitize the company and make it more digital as opposed to kind of old school way of doing things. But he's certainly not pursuing a strategy of large deals as the prior CEO. He's focused on profitability and execution organic growth, which I like. So part of the due diligence that I've done is I had a call over a year ago with an ex Arcadius executive who was fired by the prior CEO or let go in the restructuring. And, you know, in that kind of a call, you almost expect the bias to be negative because, look, you were let go from this company. It's very tempting for you to want to say, hey, yes, you know, things are terrible here without me and, you know, everything is falling apart. And what this person actually told me is like, no, you know, yes, a couple of good people left, but there's still most of the good people are still there and they're actually energized to have an engineer with a credible background coming in and lead them. So that was, you know, a positive data point because in a human capital business that's undergoing, you know, even a moderate turnaround, culture matters a lot, right? You don't want to just do this by the numbers. You really want to understand, is this kind of a sinking ship and the best people are leaving, or if this is a culture that's intact. So another, you know, approach I took is that you can look at Glassdoor, you know, for free, glassdoor.com, and you can look at how employees or potential employees are rating the company. And one, what I would bring your attention to is that lower left quadrant of that chart in the middle, which is the overall trend. And this, you know, the time period pretty much coincides with when the new CEO took over. By the way, I've looked at a lot of these. There aren't many companies where that number is changing so meaningfully. And, you know, the number, the ratings tend to be for all companies kind of in the 3 to 4.5 range. I'll show you in a minute. So while it might seem like it's a small change, it's really not. It's a 5-point scale, but most companies you would see fairly flat trend overall. So clearly, at least from this survey, there's improvement. The other question I asked is, well, how does it compare to both the industry and, you know, just some of the best companies out there? And I researched their competitors, and you can see that Arcadius is meaningfully better than the average. Again, the scale is fairly tight. It's a 5-point scale, but there's almost no one rated a 1 or 5. So it's really a compressed scale. So 3.8 versus an average of 3.4 is meaningful. And, you know, as is, you know, percentage of people who approve of the CEO, you can see is 87%. So that's good to see. And just for context, I included three companies that probably, if you think of like which companies are worldwide that are some of the better managed companies, these companies might come to mind, just to show you what the top of the range looks like. So Arcadia is actually not terribly far from the top of the range for these type of ratings. So that's another data point kind of confirming that the culture is intact, that people are not fleeing and so forth. The other criteria is alignment, and I like to see a compensation system that is balanced, but in particular what I like seeing is a focus on either economic profit or return on invested capital. Because ultimately, at a time, you're going to see a standard kind of consultant design compensation system where you have your smorgasbords of metrics, but the company can do just a lot of deals and, you know, make a lot of money. And so I like the fact that the company has a meaningful ROIC component here, that they have a focus on free cash flow for the CFO, which is important. They also have, this is for the bonus, for the long-term incentives, they have a total return versus peer group on a 3-year basis. So I think that's not unreasonable. You know, I'd say in an ideal world, I would like to see an even bigger economic EVA kind of component. But I would say this is pretty good. And I look at hundreds of these. And so this is definitely in the top quartile of aligning incentives. So I would say in summary, this is a turnaround. Management matters a lot. There's no meaningful sign of undesired turnover, both from my primary research and also one little trick is if you have a premium account on LinkedIn, you can actually click on the Insights tab and it'll show you meaningful alumni and meaningful recent hires among the management and trends in hiring and so forth. So it's a little, you know, again, a little free way of doing research. You can see what senior people have left and where are they. Do they go to competitors or did they go and, you know, put a consulting wrapper around themselves, which usually means they're probably fired and didn't have a very good alternative to go to. So that those checks turned out okay. So employee morale seems to be improving. I think the incentives are reasonably well aligned. I think the CEO's back to basics approach of just execution, focusing on profitable projects and organic growth makes sense. That being said, look, he's still unproven. He's never been a public company CEO. So I would say that it's not fair to say he's amazing because there's no evidence of that. But I would say he's promising. I also like the fact that you have the foundation that I mentioned that owns 18% of the shares that has a measure of oversight, making sure that he's going to be, you know, leading the company in the right direction. So my current assessment is that management is average with a bias towards thinking that it's actually above average. So balance sheet quality, and, you know, usually, at least in the past, John, I haven't spent too much time on balance sheets, you know, in these presentations because usually, like, you know, it's net cash or it's fairly clean. I'm going to spend a lot of time on the balance sheet because there's a short thesis out there, and I think it's important to address it because I take it very seriously. So, you know, what determines balance sheet quality? Number one is you want to be able to withstand temporary adversity without needing to raise capital. That's important. And number two is you want to have appropriate leverage relative to profitability, because if you don't, what that really means, let's say you're well way over levered, that means that the free cash flow you have is not really free, because that means that the first claim on that free cash flow would be to reduce debt, right? And then you have to adjust for that. So those are important considerations. So I spoke to the main short seller, and I spoke to them because I really do believe strongly, and I can't highlight this enough, in seeking out opposing points of view. And usually it's hard because sometimes you ask a friend or someone says, well, it's just a pass, you know. Maybe it's not that interesting, and that's okay, but that doesn't give you as strong of a debiasing kind of, you know, effect as you would like. So on the other hand, if someone is, you know, putting a lot of money on the line, betting that the stock will go down and go down a lot, maybe even to zero, they really believe it. So they're going to go and do their work. And so I take their work seriously. B, I think that's the right person to talk to understand the strongest possible bear case on the company. So the way I understood the short thesis following my conversation is as follows. So there's this, you know, basically you have a company that's understating its debt materially, according to the short seller. the company is overstating its profits. It will have trouble refinancing its debt in the coming year, and it's going to implode just as some other European companies such as Carillion, Capita, and Mighty have recently. So I'm going to address that, and sorry for going a little bit into detail, but given that the stock essentially got cut in half, largely my guess is based on this view, I think it's important to address it. So point number one, short thesis point number one is Arcadis is understating its debt. The math that the short sellers are using to reach the conclusion is as follows. So the company has gross interest expense report in the cash flow statement. It has a disclosure for the weighted average interest rate on that gross debt. And so the idea is you divide one number by the other and you get what the weighted average, daily weighted average debt really is, and that's much higher than what the company is reporting in the balance sheet. And therefore, the assertion is that they're manipulating things somehow to report this, you know, artificially low end of period number, but the debt is really much higher, and this is going to come home to roost. So I think there is an alternative explanation that I actually find more likely, having done some digging. I think that what the company does, it has notional pool accounting, so they have various corporate sub-corporate entities that lend and borrow from each other and from the parent, and you know, basically to make sure to allocate the results that's kept track of. So the cash flow statement also has a meaningful cash interest received, and I believe a significant portion of this cash interest received is based on this intercompany borrowing. So if you were to net that from the gross interest received, you would get much closer to the reported level of gross debt. The other point, and this is something that I can't be 100% sure, but I do believe that there's some pension-related interest expense in the gross debt number as well. So the combination of those two things, I would say, largely explains the difference. The other thing, what I've done is, so one of our LPs is a CFO of a large public company. So I reached out to him and I said, look, you know, I have these accounting questions. You're a CFO. And I said, I know this is going to be an awkward question, but if you wanted to commit financial fraud, and not that you ever would, but you wanted to understate debt, how would you do it? Like, short of just completely making numbers up, what would be your methodology? And he said, well, you know, the two, you know, A, I would never do it, so I haven't given it much thought, but now that I've thought about it, you know, two obvious ways would be, you know, around the end of the period, you would pull, you would pull forward receivables, or you would delay payables. And this company, just looking at the relative amounts, it just doesn't have the ability to do that to the extent that the delta between what the shorts believe the debt should be and what the reported debt is. They're trying to collect receivables as hard as they can, and that's a separate issue. So it's not like they can move an amount that's $400 million purely based on that. So anyway, that's point number one. Point number two is the company is overstating EBITDA. They basically are building this ERP system that's not yet operational, and they're capitalizing that expense in intangibles. Again, my conversation with the CFO and also just experience and first principles thinking as well is this makes perfect sense. You have a long-term asset you're creating, an ERP system, you're spending cash on it, but you're not deriving any benefit from it today. So just accounting 101, it perfectly makes sense to basically capitalize that and amortize it over the useful life of that system once it comes into operation. And the CFO confirmed for me that when they had a similar situation, that's the standard accounting method they followed. So I won't belabor the point there. Point number three, you know, the company, you know, is that the company is going to have trouble refinancing near-term maturities. I think, you know, I've done a fair amount of digging to understand their profile. So they do have their revolver coming due in 2019, and that's a risk factor. There's no way to say it's not. Now, it's a fairly common occurrence. A lot of companies have, you know, say 3-year revolver or 5-year revolver, and at some point you have to negotiate it. So, you know, if everything were to shut down completely, let's say this is 2008-2009, that would be, you know, an unfortunate timing. But in the normal course of business, this happens all the time. And also, they had a $90 million private placement notes that are maturing in 2018. We don't know for sure if they got, you know, refinanced or not. My guess is they probably did, because we didn't see any announcements, and they probably got refinanced using the available revolver capacity. So I think, you know, is it possible that, you know, the markets will shut down and banks will get extremely risk averse just in that 1 month period when they're finalizing the revolver? It's possible, you know, of course, you know, I'm not going to lie and say it's not. That being said, the company is well within its debt covenants. It's producing fairly consistent free cash flow, well in excess of the dividends. It's already committed to reducing debt even further to put even bigger cushion between themselves and the covenants. And the business is growing and management is focused on profitability. Also, fairly a good amount of the debt structure is termed out a number of years out, according to the annual report. So it's possible that something is going to go wrong. I view it as a small probability. And I think that if I'm correct, this is going to get resolved in 2019, and it's going to remove a perceived risk factor for the company. Another balance sheet issue that, you know, both the short sellers point out and that I'm aware of is they have a money-losing JV that the new CEO inherited from the prior management in Brazil. They are basically guaranteeing the debt of this JV to the tune of about 86 million euros. That's now on the balance sheet. You know, I think that it should be on the balance sheet. Now, they're trying to get rid of this JV, and the JV is on the cusp of profitability. But, you know, as of now, it's not profitable. And so if the JV were to file for bankruptcy tomorrow, that 86 million would be Arcadius's debt, and I'm treating it as such in my analysis. So I think that that's fair, and there's no, you know, the company is not hiding that in any way. It's, you know, fairly upfront about the situation. So in terms of, you know, the other balance sheet issue is the company have some receivables that are fairly stale. So you can see in this chart that there's 127 million of receivables that are older than 120 days, and some of them are much older. So what that is they, you know, before the oil price collapse, there was a boom in Middle Eastern infrastructure projects, and some of these, you know, clients are the same ones that are using bonsaws to chop up people into little pieces. So they're not your normal kind of corporate American clients where you can just sue them or something like that and say pay up. You know, they have their own way of doing things, and so it's a process. The current management is much more aware of this, and they're not doing many new projects, if any, on those terms, but they have to do their best to collect those old receivables. So the worst case, in my view, is that none of those get paid and that their reserves of 55 million are just insufficient. So if we assume that, we assume that there's another 72 million hit to the balance sheet that they would have to replace. And I think that that's not the base case, but, you know, I think it's worth considering and incorporating into our range of values. So as far as debt covenants, they have the main covenant is they have 3x net debt to EBITDA. On a reported basis, there were 2.2 times. If we include the JV guarantee, that would be 2.6 times. If we assume that they would immediately need to replace all 72 million of additional receivables, which would not be the case. It's not like there was some urgency to do it in any 1 month or something like that. They would be at 2.9 times, and that's before assuming any improvement in EBITDA or any debt reduction from the free cash flow that they're generating. So their goal is to be under 2x debt to EBITDA, net debt to EBITDA, and they're reducing their debt with their cash, but they're still, even if you make some of these assumptions, they're still okay. And one thing I always like to see, especially if there's any questions about the balance sheet, is what's happening to free cash flow. And both from a ability to pay down debt point of view, as well as from a quality of earnings point of view. So from a quality of earnings point of view, what you want to see is you want to see over a period of time, say a 5 to 10 year period, you want to see free cash flow and net income, you know, within 25% of each other. There's some growth, you know, as you're growing organically, you would expect to have working capital grow a bit, or maybe some growth CapEx. But by and large, if you're a mature company, the two shouldn't be vastly different. And they're not. In this case, they're, you know, 82% of net income converted into free cash flow. You also have, you know, basically a situation where in 2017, their free cash flow to equity was almost 100 million. And that compares to the, you know, current market of cap of under a billion and reported net debt of less than 500 million. So, you know, they have substantial financial firepower as far as you know, over the next few years, reducing debt even further if they choose to. Or if this passes, they refinance or they term out the debt, they can really devote that firepower towards buying back undervalued shares. So I think that, you know, if the picture were different and this company was losing money on a cash flow basis, I would be a lot more worried. The fact that even before any meaningful improvement, that they're very much cash rich gives me an extra margin of safety, I would say. So in summary, again, I've done my best to cover all my bases. I can always be wrong. You know, I'm not, you know, that's why I own more than one company, you know, in the portfolio, despite my concentration, because I don't want to be arrogant and think I have all the answers. But to the best of my ability to analyze, I believe that the short seller's allegations are incorrect, that the company is going to be fine on the balance sheet. And I would say the company's balance sheet is fairly average. I mean, if you zoom out and you say a company that is not deeply cyclical and already has a portion of its business near trough demand as far as energy infrastructure and some parts of its Latin American business, and it's, if I'm right, and it's a, call it 2.5 times net debt to EBITDA, if I just gave you those facts, you wouldn't be terribly concerned. Is there some small chance there's some massive fraud that I'm completely unaware of and missed? It's always a non-zero probability, but all the analysis I've done leads me to believe that that's not the case. Moving on, I don't think I've ever spent so much time on explaining the balance sheet, but you know, it's probably warranted. So in this case, the turnaround is fairly straightforward. You know, the key economic variables are organic sales growth, degree to which the company can restore its prior margin levels, and how much of its free cash flow needs to be used to improve the balance sheet. So historically, you can see here, organic growth rate has been, you know, low single digits, 3% over the 05 through 17 period. Interestingly enough, if you look at the worst couple of years, they've been, you know, in less than 5% decline, even in the worst of recessions. So I would say, you know, that's a good thing, because I think both from a, you know, perspective of how, you know, much leverage the company can sustain, and also that, you know, this is not a deeply cyclical company where, you know, revenues can decline 20% if things go wrong or something like that. I also think that, you know, as I said, a substantial part of the business, energy-related infrastructure plus Brazil, is pretty much near trough demand. You know, I think those two combined right now about 10% of the business, but at, you know, normal levels of demand, they were probably, you know, much more than that, maybe more than twice that. So you already have a component that's well below mid-cycle levels. And offsetting that, I would say that you have pieces of the business such as the U.S. commercial-related piece that's above trend, probably close to peak. My assumption is that overall we're pretty close to mid-cycle levels of demand for this business because of those two offsetting factors, and that I would say longer term, a 0 to 5% organic growth range with a base case of 3% doesn't sound unreasonable to me. In terms of margins, so the company is average in EBITDA, so I don't look at EBITDA very much, but EBITDA margins are close to 10%, and recently it's been closer to 7%. Some of the issues have been kind of the declines in some of those cyclical businesses I mentioned, but also the fact that the old, you know, CEO didn't really understand things and focus on growth. And as a result, they were, you know, taking on projects at less than desirable profitability. So what the new CEO is doing is, you know, telling people, you know, you got to price accordingly. We are very comfortable walking away from business because there's enough demand out there. We'd rather have a little bit less revenue, but have price discipline longer term because we offer a differentiated service. So he is slowly, you know, not repricing because it's not for existing contracts, but it's, as he's taking on new contracts, he is pricing them more appropriately for a higher level of margins. They're doing a little bit of cost cutting, but not too much, because they don't want to cut into, you know, the golden goose, which is the engineering staff and design staff. So it's not really a cost cutting story. It's really a combination of being more selective on projects, increasing revenue moderately, and just, you know, a little bit of cost cutting to get us part way back there. And when I say part way, I'm really modeling a range between, you know, current levels and 10% with the base case of 8.5. So I'm not assuming that we get back to the long-term history. I'm only assuming we get part way there through their efforts in the base case. As far as the balance sheet in the Allen JV, I'm just assuming that the Allen JV is debt until I know otherwise. And I basically assume that in different scenarios that they'll need to pay to basically replace different percentages of the account receivables that are stale. So in the worst case, it's all of them. In the base case, it's half of them. In the best case, it's a quarter. So I'm trying to do my best to quantify those issues and account for them in my value. So financial modeling, as I mentioned, my worst case tends to be a pretty severe worst case. It's one of the mistakes, you know, when I was a young analyst and then when I mentored as a portfolio manager, younger analysts, one of the mistakes I've always observed is that they have an insufficiently conservative worst case. I've seen, you know, a number of times where people have come to me with companies where they're trading at 20 times earnings and they say, oh, the worst case is 15% downside. And my response is usually, really? And what happens typically is when then the company is down 30-40%, the analyst is shell-shocked because he never even imagined things could get that bad. So in my attempt, at least, is to have a kind of a two-stern deviation worst case. Not that everything possible goes wrong, because you can always come up with some, you know, everything is a fraud kind of case, but, you know, stress testing things fairly severely, and that's how I underwrite, so just for context. So in this case, I'm assuming that in the worst case that revenues take a step down in the worst case from the current levels, and they basically don't grow. I assume that margins stay at the current level, and I assume that the JV continues to lose the money that it's losing, and essentially that's it. You know, that's, I'm also assuming that they need to replace the stale receivables on the balance sheet. In the base case, I'm assuming, you know, the revenues on a normalized basis are, you know, maybe 5-6% higher than last four quarters. That margins, as I mentioned, are 8.5%, and that, you know, they basically get rid of the JV, but they don't necessarily make any money on it. And I'm assuming low single-digit growth rate from here. By the way, I'm assuming that this will take a couple of years, and that in the meantime, they are going to basically make a lot less than my normalized amount of profitability. So as you can see, with the range, you know, so is, you know, I get slightly north of a euro in my worst case as normalized earnings, all the way to my best case of 236. Again, I don't want to have false precision, obviously. You know, these are approximate numbers, but I would say, considering that this is an 10-11 euro stock, having a base case earnings power of euro 66. This seems pretty compelling if I'm correct. As far as valuation, my main approach is a DCF. I know the criticism sometimes of DCF is that there's a garbage in, garbage out approach and that it's false precision, so forth. I disagree. I think that, well, I don't disagree. There is a garbage in, garbage out approach, but it's almost like saying you can hit your finger with a hammer and therefore you shouldn't use it. I mean, I think the solution is to use the tool properly, not if it's the best tool, not to, you know, take unnecessary shortcuts. But at the same time, I do a lot of sanity checks. I look at private market transactions. I look at normalized PE, right, or appropriate price to book, or EV to EBITDA, to make sure that my valuation makes sense. So in this case, in the worst case, I'm coming up with 7.5 euros of base of DCF value, which is about 30% downside from here. It implies a 10 times PE, and also that they have a substantial balance sheet hit for the reasons I mentioned earlier. My base case, I come up with 21 euros, which puts the stock at, you know, 50 cents in the dollar, and basically that implies 13 times normalized earnings. And then my best case, I come up with almost 40 euros, and it implies 17 times normalized earnings. One, you know, I looked at a few transactions in the space. I think averages are misleading, which is why I picked three. I didn't cherry pick. I try to find big ones because there are a lot of small ones, and also I try to find ones where the mix of business, which varies a lot by company, is at least somewhat similar. And the three transactions, I looked at an EV to EBITDA basis just because adjust for capital structure and differences. you know, the range was between 8 times EV to EBITDA to, you know, 13.5 times EV to EBITDA. In my base case, valuation implies 9.4 times. So I feel that if anything, these private market transactions imply a higher value, but that makes sense because there's a strategic premium in there and there's the ability to extract cost synergies built in. So we shouldn't think that what private and strategic buyers pay is the standalone value of the business. You know, that they have a reason to pay more if they, you know, if they can actually execute on that. By the way, this company told it could get bought. You know, I think this is a business where market share changes slowly. As you saw, organic revenue growth doesn't move around that much. So if someone wants to get stronger in, say, Europe, this would be a pretty good asset for them to buy. But that's not the base case. I'm not hoping for takeout, but it would be always nice to be in a situation where both the valuation is attractive and it's feasible to have potential upside from a strategic acquirer coming in and buying the business. So, you know, one thing I wanted to do is say, well, let's say I'm wrong about the short sellers being incorrect in their analysis. And let's say the company is understating that exactly like the short sellers are talking about. So what I've done here, and I'll let you look at the slide for the numbers, but I basically said, how much capital would they need to raise to replace the hole in the balance sheet created by this, you know, let's say there's an announcement tomorrow. We found that we were understating debt by, you know, this amount happens to be based on my calculations around 380 million. And we desperately need to raise capital. Obviously that would not make me happy, but rather than just being afraid of a negative scenario, I think it's important to say, well, how bad will it get for us? So I'm assuming here that they raise capital at distressed prices, which I used a 50% discount, 50, to the current equity prices as a proxy for what, you know, they would have to, you know, be able to raise capital. Obviously that's arbitrary, but it, you know, it's already, you know, basically it's a stock that got cut in half, and I'm assuming another 50% you know, haircut as far as what they can raise capital at. So essentially that would take our base case value from 21 euros to 12 euros. That's not a good outcome, but it's also not a disaster, meaning that, you know, the stock is trading at less than that right now. So I think that it's important, rather than just to have blind fear of some unknown, you know, severe event, to try to quantify it and say, okay, if the worst comes to pass, do we lose everything? Or is it not as bad as that? Some other sensitivities, you know, obviously, you know, what if, for instance, sales are flat instead of 3%? You know, what if margins don't improve? You know, what if the worst case comes to pass for the balance sheet related items for the JV and the receivables? In each of those scenarios, again, I'll let you look at the specifics, but the stock would still be undervalued. So, I mean, again, it's nice to not have to have everything go your way in order to be right on the investment. I think it's important to have that margin of safety that you can be wrong here and can be wrong there and still have a decent outcome. Maybe not as good as you would hope, but certainly not a bad one. So behavioral checklist, you know, usually, you know, I try to go through a checklist of biases. You know, it's obviously, so for something like that, an obvious one would be the endowment effect. I own the stock. You know, am I purposefully trying to disregard, you know, disconfirming information, you know, for instance, of my anchored, things like that. Part of the reason, you know, for my seeking out a short seller was to try to combat those biases. And I've done my best to try to think through and keep an open mind to their points and research them and not just disregard them or think that they're incorrect just because I don't want them to be true. That being said, look, I don't think it's possible to eliminate all behavioral biases. I think the best we can do is minimize them. I think that, you know, I would be kidding myself if I thought that I could be 100% unbiased. But I think I've done my best to minimize them in this case, and I feel good that I've taken the appropriate steps here. So in terms of the portfolio construction, and then I'll wrap up and, you know, let John ask me questions if you have any. You know, typically I have criteria for price to value that I require a new investment to have based on quality. So in this case, Arcadis is an above average company based on my assessment. So I would want to, you know, have it be no more expensive than 65% of base case value, and it clearly meets that criteria. In terms of position sizing, I try to make sure that for the larger position sizes, it's not just statistical undervaluation, but it's also a reasonable amount of quality, and you know that all everything lines up. So, you know, for instance, you know, for going from a small position to a medium position, I want the balance sheet to be average or better, management to be average or better, and the business to be average or better. While for a large position, I want everything to be above average, to be a large position. And I also want to have moderate downside to worst case for medium and large positions. If I look at this situation, this started as a small position in March of 2017 at around 14 euros when the stock fell below 65% of my estimated base case value. And then in more recently in 2018, I increased it to a medium position at prices between 11 and 14 euros where the stock was within 15, 60% of base case value. Why not a large position? Well, because a couple of things. One is it doesn't fit the above average criteria on balance sheet and certainly not yet on management because I'm proven and that's a criteria for a large position. And second, because I could be wrong. You know, in my analysis, I believe strongly that I'm right. I feel I substantiated with analysis and evidence, but nonetheless, I don't want to be arrogant and I don't want to have a situation where, you know, if I am mistaken in my balance sheet analysis, it's such a huge percentage of the portfolio that it's hard to recover from that. So I think I'm happy with the position size. I think that 2019 will be an interesting year because some of the negatives should go away, such as refinancing risk. And I'm looking forward to watching the management team execute, and make progress on its objectives. Lastly, if you want to follow up with me, more than happy to exchange ideas, discuss anything and everything investing related. You can see my email here, and as well as the website for Silvering Value Partners. I also about once a month write articles on investment related topics and behavioral finance at behavioralvalueinvestor.com. So feel free to visit that. And with that, John, happy to answer any questions.
Gary, thank you so much for such a thorough presentation. Especially appreciate you also addressing the short seller concerns. I think that's always important to do. Could you elaborate a little bit more on the management and how open they have been to talking about the balance sheet, the potential issues, and also how they've responded to some of the short seller concerns?
Yeah, no, I think that's an excellent question. I think that I think they've been reasonably accessible. They had a capital markets day fairly early on where the CEO has explained his strategy and his approach. I think they're very, for instance, they're fairly transparent about things like the Allen JV. And so they're not hiding that in the footnotes. They're putting it in a slide deck, right? And a lot of times, management's try to get away with burying stuff like that in the footnotes and hope nobody notices. But, they're talking about it openly. It's in the slide. They're explaining what they're doing. I think that that's the only thing they can do. I don't think the concerns were brought up in a public forum as far as, hey, you guys are actually committing fraud. What do you think? but I think that as some of the short sellers presented, I think recently at a conference where they kind of explained their view more publicly, my hope and my guess is that the company will address this because I think that's important. And I think that, hopefully they provide additional clarity on things like, what the components of the issue with gross interest expense and that the strongest point the short seller makes, right, is that, if you divide the cash interest, gross interest by the weighted average interest rate, you get a much higher debt number. I feel that it's important that management addresses that, and I think they will, because I think it would be foolish of them not to, especially if they have nothing to hide. I think they'll give us components. Another thing I would say is not a lot of companies go through the receivables by cohort and give that level of reserving. So I think that they're trying to be as transparent as possible about both the facts and their plan of action for dealing with the situation. And I respect that. I don't think they're promotional. I don't feel that they're trying to say there's not a problem. They're not in denial. And at the same time, they could still fail because the situation might get out of their control somehow. Let's say in Brazil, they can't sell an asset. That's possible. But I feel that I like the way they're handling the communication, basically, is what I'm trying to say.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Also, could you elaborate on capital allocation going forward? Do you think they should prioritize debt reduction to the exclusion of everything else?
You know, it's interesting, right? You know, my initial kind of thought was that they should be buying back stock aggressively. That's my normal reaction when I have a company trading at such a big discount to my estimated value. And I addressed that with the company. I said, well, why aren't you guys doing a bigger? And they said, well, look, you know, our covenants are 3x. We are at 2.2, but if you bring in the JV guarantee, we're really at 2.6. And we're conservative, and we want to make sure we put a bigger distance between the covenant and where we are. So what they did say also is that, look, once the, for instance, let's say we get rid of that JV, and we also reduce debt a little bit, by all means, we're going to use the excess free cash flow to buy back our shares. They have a dividend that they're paying. I think, I forget off the top of my head, but I think it's 20 to 30 million. And if they're generating about 100 million per year, that leaves them another, call it 70 million, 60 to 70 million, depending on the year, where they can buy back stock. And that, you know, that means they can buy back 6 to 7% of the company each year. So I think that they will do that. I also think that because they have this longer term European approach to the business, they are trying to optimize for removing even an already low chance of something going wrong rather than trying to optimize the value. Normally I'd be frustrated, but I think especially given the allegations and given that the receivables issues, I think it's prudent. If those issues were resolved and they still didn't do any share buybacks, I would then be disappointed and I would then question the degree to which they are understanding kind of an appropriate intrinsic value framework. But I'll contrast that. So I had a due diligence call with a different company this morning, and I asked them the same question: how do you think about share buyback in the context of your capital allocation strategy? And the answer I got was very different from what these guys have told me. And the answer I got from the company I spoke to this morning was, well, you know, evidence shows that, you know, share buybacks don't increase P multiples, so therefore we're not prioritizing that. And I didn't own that company. I didn't argue with the management, but I said, that's interesting. No, the right answer would have been, you know, we're trying to maximize our intrinsic value per share, subject to having a safe capital structure, and that we want to make sure that the remaining shareholders have, you know, as much value after we explain the facts about a business to every shareholder so that they can make up their mind. So, you know, I don't get a sense from the Arcadis management that they don't get it. I get the sense that they want to be prudent and make sure that balance sheet is not even a potential consideration, and then they'll do the buybacks.
Terrific, Gary. I'll leave it there. I would just encourage our members to feel free to follow up with you with their own thoughts or questions. Thank you also for showing your contact information here on the screen. Once again, truly appreciate you being here and taking the time to share this idea with our community.
Thank you, John. Pleasure is mine.
Goodbye for now.
Bye-bye.